And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and today on the show we're going to be talking to Christopher Black, a Toronto lawyer who has triumphed in a major case at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It's a long trial, and it, of course, had to go not only through the trial but through the appeal. And on appeal, he has his client has been found not guilty, acquitted, I don't know whichever word I'm supposed to use. Anyway, it's Christopher Black, quite an outstanding lawyer, and gained an awful lot of experience in these years since they've decided to establish international courts and so-called ad hoc courts and the ICC. There's a lot of debate about the value of these courts and whether or not they're profoundly biased, which would be my opinion, but maybe I'm profoundly biased. This is the Taylor Report, and at the halfway point, we will be talking to yet another prominent Toronto lawyer, Peter Rosenthal, who is also a mathematician, and he is going to be talking to us about the loss of our friend Lee Lorch, who was a guest on our show on a number of occasions. Lee Lorch was a champion of human rights. He died here in Toronto, and Peter will be talking about him and his career. If you did not know this, the New York Times has written quite a long and informative obituary on Lee Lorch, who was his work, particularly in the civil rights field in Arkansas and New York, could be studied. If you want to know about the battle to end segregation, you could do it through the life of Lee Lorch, because he fought segregation after being a World War II veteran coming home to New York. He fought it in New York, and he also fought in Arkansas. He and his wife, he gave a lot of credit to his wife. Anyway, we'll talk about all these matters with Peter Rosenthal at about 5:30. And I believe we're joined on the line by Christopher Black.
Correct.
Ah, Chris, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Well, it's very well. Good to hear you. I'm glad you're safely back from far away East Africa.
Yes, I'm sorry to hear about Lee Lorch.
Yeah, it is. By the way, you must have known him. I may as well ask you. He was an outstanding man, was he not?
Yes, he was a very courageous, distinguished fellow. He was still struggling long in his 90s, so he was a very tough guy, but very, very real intellectual.
Talk about a lived life. Mm. And we had him on the show, and he shared anecdotes of his visit with Albert Einstein. So this is, I'd like to be able, now I can say I shook hands with the man who shook hands with Albert Einstein. I belong to the club that, you know, the handshake collection. But now you've really achieved an important victory in our. Our listeners need to know about this. You represented General Augustin Dindilimana, who was accused originally of being accused throughout of being a part of a conspiracy to commit genocide in Rwanda, together with other army officers.
Right.
And tell us how long this trial. Tell us about your client, how long it took for this trial to wend its way through to your final victory of last week.
Well, it took 14 years. He was arrested in February 2000. The trial didn't start for 4 years after that for no reason except that they had no case. They were trying to concoct one. And then the trial started in September 2004. It ran through till mid-2009. Then we waited a year and a half, 2 years for the judgment on the trial. Then he was acquitted of most of the substantive charges in 2011, released, but then he was convicted of two failed to punish charges, and then the prosecution appealed all the acquittals, so we just finished with dealing with that. And February the 11th, he was acquitted on everything.
Yes, and now, will he be returned? You say it's a total, he's been away from his family, is it 11, 14 years?
14 years now.
14 years.
Over 14 years, yeah.
14 years.
Yes, and
so
is
he being returned to the bosom of his family, and is any kind of compensation for the loss to them and all his suffering and their suffering? I remember his son died, by the way,
right,
and he asked, could he go to his son, was dying in a hospital in Belgium, and they refused.
Right. His son was dying of leukemia. He was 14. He was a twin of his sister named Eileen. His name was Eileen Alland. So they wouldn't allow him to... Well, the tribunal officially allowed him back, but it came back to the Belgian government whether they would have permitted, and that danced between different ministries, and they just passed the buck, and then his son died in the meantime, so he never got to attend the funeral or anything else. Mm-hmm. But as far as compensation and what's happening now, like the rest of the acquitted, I should say, those men mm-hmm. who've been acquitted at the tribunal, all of them are still stuck in a UN safe house in Arusha in Tanzania, and aren't being permitted back to the countries in which they were arrested, even though most of them have status in those countries. And it's a world scandal, and nobody seems to be doing anything about it. So although they've been found innocent, they're still stuck basically in exile.
Yes. The International Criminal Tribunal appears to be a kind of a script out of Kafka, right?
Yeah. It's
is that fair?
Worse. It's even worse than Kafka, because it's when you find out the reasons why things were done, it's more diabolical in Kafka. You never know what's happening. But here we know why they're doing it. And it's very bad what they're doing. It's criminal what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Their charges were basically fabricated against all these men. Mm-hmm. And that was proven in the outcome. Mm-hmm. And it's important because they've now acquitted all the government ministers and all the senior army and police officers who allegedly conspired to exterminate Tutsis. So if you have no government conspiracy, no military conspiracy, then there is no conspiracy, and then there wasn't any, and that never happened that way. And everybody has to ask what really happened in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. And you have a body of competent individuals, particularly in the case of your client, by the way, where there really wasn't much dispute about his character. I seem to recall General Dallaire speaking rather positively of him.
Right.
And actually it was assumed he would never be charged, but because of what appeared to be a political argument in Belgium, they ended up bringing charges.
Yeah, he was considered by the RPF and those who support that, their mythology, like this dichotomy between extremists and moderate Hutus. And if you accept that dichotomy, we don't, but mm-hmm. then General Ndili Mana fitted into the moderate category. Mm-hmm. Because he was quite close to the Tutsis and saved many Tutsis. His gendarmes protected Tutsis wherever they could.
Yes, by the way, it wasn't known that he had Tutsi lieutenants who were in the gendarmerie, which according to the great mythology couldn't be possible.
Right. Two structures of that myth, or two pillars of that myth, are that it was a Hutu government, which it was not. When the plane went shot down, it was a mixed ethnic regime in which Tutsis allied to the RPF held key ministries. Mm-hmm. And the army and the gendarmerie had Tutsi officers and men inside them, and they stayed with those units until they retreated to Zaire. Mm-hmm. There were more Tutsis in the gendarmerie than the army, but nevertheless, there were some Tutsis even in the army. So the idea that the army could go around exterminating people that to which its members belong is absurd.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were so many. By the way, you brought out in the courtroom some matters that I wish the Canadian people were getting reports on your court work, mm-hmm. and also so that they could understand. Usually trials, one of the things they're supposed to show the public is what actually occurred.
Right.
Now, you brought out the fact that a lieutenant of General Ndili Mana, by lieutenant I mean someone aiding him directly, was working as an investigator and assistant to the prosecutor.
Yes, we had three or four instances in which we found that people working on our team were actively helping or feeding information to the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And that happened in a number of trials.
But they also, you had one employed by the prosecutor.
Yes.
I mean, in other words, he was doing their, he was part of the team.
Right.
And the prosecutor was giving General Ndili Mana a hard time about, he should have known about a crime, but they had someone serving them who would have been the person to know that himself.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's very strange, the whole, that happened in other trials too, but I can tell you many stories about what happened in our trial, but it'd be 6 months about the things they did.
Well, certainly. Well, tell us this, by the way. Why did they separate Augustine Bizimungu?
That's very
interesting. Because that case has not been settled.
No, the rumors are, and this is, the rumors only from the grapevine, but the strong rumor is that he was going to be acquitted too. But there is, it seems there's been some hesitation on one of the judges' parts, so they're giving the prosecution a second kick at the can to prove their non-existent case, and hopefully that if that argument can't be made, which it cannot, then they'll finally acquit him. Mm-hmm. So I think they're under a lot of political pressure to, if they went ahead and acquitted two chiefs of staff, the chief of staff of the Army and the gendarmerie, at the same time on the 20th anniversary, there's a lot of political pressure, I imagine. I mean, we don't know exactly. Nothing at the tribunal is clear or transparent. You never know what's happening, unlike other courts in here, where people are used to. So you're not sure what's happening.
Yes.
But they said in their order severing his case from ours just before the judgment, on the eve of the judgment date, they said that they had doubts about the prosecution case connecting the facts they knew with the illegal connection with a conviction, which means they should have acquitted him, obviously.
We're speaking to Christopher Black. He's a Toronto lawyer and has just won one of the biggest cases tried before an international tribunal, representing General Dindilimana. Augustin. Christopher, I was reading Carla Del Ponte's memoir, or her account of being a prosecutor at the ICTY. And she said that when she took over, she determined that she was going to be a fair prosecutor, and she said that if you don't prosecute all persons who committed crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide in Rwanda, then it would be victor's justice and it would not be a proper tribunal and it would be a failure, she said. She might have even used stronger words. So what can you tell us, using Carla Del Ponte's criteria, what would we have here?
Well, it's quite clear from the fact that all the acquitted men cannot return to the countries in which they're arrested, that they were never intended to be acquitted. That was never the intention. The expectation and the intention was they were all going to be convicted because this was victor's justice. They only targeted, when you look at who they chose to charge, they chose selected individuals from the cabinet ministers of the government, selected army officers and gendarme officers, selected mayors, selected prefects, the governors of the provinces, and selected intellectuals. And also some, in Europe, they're charging some of the Catholic priests, of course. So they targeted a cross-section of the Hutus who had any power or influence in government or military and intellectuals. The RPF doesn't want any Hutus like that to be running around loose who might be able to run the country.
Well, trained professionals, had actually done their job lawfully, of course, they would have a clear standing and a chance to provide political or military leadership their country. They are Rwandans.
Yes.
And they're not criminals.
No, they're very valuable men. They're a valuable resource. They're very
The country trained them and relied upon them and paid them a salary, and they should be returned to what they were doing, except that there seems, she said, it would be victor's justice, and that apparently is what it is.
Right, because we now know from the series of trials that have taken place that most of the killings were committed by the RPF and their allies, none of the RPF officers or men have been charged and never will be. The ICTR prosecutor protected Kagame and Museveni and all the other officers who committed those massacres. And so then that gave a green light to Kagame and Museveni to invade Congo and kill millions of people in Zaire and Congo because they knew they were immune from prosecution.
Invaded them twice.
Exactly. And they've committed mass atrocities there with impunity because they've been given impunity by the very tribunal set up to prosecute war crimes.
Now, by the way, very specifically, Carla Del Ponte, former prosecutor at the ICTR, she said that she particularly wanted to look into the case, not only of the shooting down of the plane, which she thought was pertinent and should be pursued, but the murder of the bishops and the priests,
yes,
at a place called Cap Guy,
right,
which was a clear case of a, you know, cold-blooded murder by personnel, and there's no disputing whose personnel they were. Those were RPF people who had taken those people in.
Right.
What happened to her desire to do that? Did you ever discuss that with people?
She was, well, from her book, she says she was pressured by the American government not to pursue, and she was forced out because of her intention. So it's quite clear that these tribunals are not controlled by neutral judges or neutral bureaucrats. There's a political agenda behind the scenes which drives everything, and they didn't want any of those crimes punished. The murder of four bishops, can you imagine machine gunning, lining up against the wall, four Catholic bishops?
Yes, sir.
And machine gunning them.
Yeah, and some
and two
priests,
Canadian priests were murdered.
One of the priests was a Tutsi who refused to leave them.
He said,
I'm with them, and they killed him.
Right. And surprisingly, the Catholic Church has not said anything about this either. And then two Canadian priests were murdered by the RPF,
mm-hmm,
and nothing. The Canadian government said nothing about that.
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, one of those priests was a personal friend or schoolmate of Jean Chrétien.
That's exactly right. Yes, and still nothing.
Yeah.
So the whole tribunal has been just twisted, and people think it's to and bring justice to war, but in fact it was victor's justice, and a very bad and a very egregious example of that.
Yeah. And by the way, doesn't it have also? I think you raised a point. I mean, we were told, and I was of course there at the beginning of this tribunal, that the opening speeches said we're going to end a culture of impunity. But actually, they've established a culture of impunity.
They have, exactly. And you see that, as I said before, what happened in Zaire afterwards. And now we have Madame Bensouda, who's now the chief prosecutor of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, who was part of the prosecution team at the ICTR and spent her entire career there protecting Kagame and other war criminals like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's in charge of prosecutions at the ICC. So what can we expect?
Yes.
From a person like that.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, Africans are being prosecuted. They say, you see, Mrs. Bensouda is an African, so you can't complain.
Well, except that only certain Africans are being prosecuted.
Yeah,
those Africans stand in the way of American and other Western interests lately.
The son of Jomo Kenyatta.
Yes, Kenyatta, Gaddafi, Gbagbo, Bemba, mm-hmm, all these people stand in their way. They don't ever charge Kagame, Museveni, and other their acolytes who commit crimes in Africa.
Yeah, so it is a culture of impunity. Now, I really hope that we can get a campaign to return those who've been released from prison to their homes. Do you sense any attention or progress in this area? Because I would think that international lawyers and should start some kind of a campaign to expose the UN's strange hypocritical handling of people who've been acquitted.
Right. Well, the prisoners, the acquitted, and before that when they were prisoners, wrote to the Security Council many times complaining about this and asking for their assistance. They haven't gotten any positive, they got some answers, but nothing very positive, no definite steps.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten worse for them because, as you may know, in the last couple of weeks, in a Rwandan newspaper, there was an article put out claiming that General Kabilegi, who's living in a safe house, I met him there just last week, he's never left it, he can't,
mm-hmm,
was meeting with the FDLR, the Democratic Liberation Forces of Rwanda, based in the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
He was meeting with some of them in Dar es Salaam with the Tanzanian officials, and they were preparing war. I mean, it's crazy, the stuff they're putting out. And the murder of Colonel Kerry Yeager a couple of months ago has them very worried because Kagame said all his opponents will be eliminated.
Yes.
So they're more than worried now. I mean, it's a very tense situation.
Well, it is. Properly, those who guarantee their security should be discussing these matters. By the way, in the murder of Karagea, there is international opinion has said who carried it out should be caught and punished, but also the government of Rwanda went too far, even for Washington's
They keep saying that, but Kagame's left in place and keeps doing these things. They make these noises every once in a while when he goes too far, but he's left there to do it again.
Yes.
That's the danger.
And he began going too far back when Lazindi, a former RPF Army officer, and Senda Shonga, former RPF minister in government, were killed in Nairobi.
Yes. In fact, when they shot down the plane and murdered two presidents, Burundi and Rwanda. And
that was sort of serious.
Yeah,
it seemed to have consequences.
And the Americans knew. I mean, they know very well who shot down that plane.
Yeah. Well, tell us something about what that court said. I mean, what did you take the most satisfaction from when you heard the court decision? Outline the basic things that we learned from your appeal.
The appeal was my satisfaction came from the trial judgment when most of the substantive charges were dismissed against the general. And the court actually said in their judgment that the case against him was a political motivation.
That's very important.
They actually said that the case against him was politically motivated. That was astounding, actually, for these judges to come to that conclusion. But we fought very hard to convince them of that, and they became convinced. And they also criticized Alison DeForge and mm-hmm. said that she was not honest with them. And because she had tried to hide information against General Ndadiliemana, which was exculpatory in his own trial.
Ooh.
And they hit her hard in a paragraph. And they also listed all the great things he did and dismissed the idea of conspiracy among these officers to commit genocide against the Tutsis. And in fact, most of the witnesses, like Belgian Ambassador Swinnen and Luc Marchal, said that the Rwandan military were for the Arusha Accords, but it was the RPF who was against it. The people don't know these things.
They do not, and thank goodness you're saying it. By the way, if you don't mind my speculating about it, my memory is that the general was living in Brussels and being treated with respect and in acknowledgement that he had done a decent job and done his best, et cetera.
Right.
And a woman named Brachman, or someone, I think it was Colette Brachman, wrote an article which he took exception to because he thought it was a serious distortion, and he thought it was his duty to speak up. So he did. And not long after that, the movement to have him charged came along. Is that accurate?
Basically, there were several things happening at the same time. I think his troubles began in December 1994 when General Dallaire passed a message through to him asking him to return to Rwanda on behalf of Washington, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
But he refused because he didn't like how things were developing in Rwanda. He refused to go back. Then this whispering campaign began with Colette Brachman, and he wrote a critique of that. He wrote a critique of Dr. DeForge's book, Leave None to Tell the Tale, saying that she was wrong in many points.
Yes, so she came and testified against him.
Yes, so we had to pull. She said favorable things about him only because we had to force her to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She was trapped in her own previous writings. Yeah. But this trial was interesting because we brought out, I'm not the only trial, military one did it, and some of the government people also, but we tried to bring out the actual day-to-day events in the war from 1990 through 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the killings were committed by the RPF forces and those that helped them.
Well, certainly the initiation, and didn't you also establish, and I think it was through General Dallaire, that the initiation of the renewal of the war came on the side of the RPF?
Right. The RPF violated the Arusha Accords from the day it was signed and was allowed to build up heavy weaponry and ammunition by the UN, by General Dallaire. Did nothing. He knew. He was aware that they were building up these forces for a final offensive, which they launched on April 6th by killing the president, and then they launched a general attack across the country.
Yes, and by the way, my memory is, I think I was in the courtroom here, I heard him say he didn't really want to speak to that point. I recall he was being asked very tightly by the defense counsel, okay, so who started it? And his answer was, well, the Rwandan government forces were in a defensive mode.
That's right.
And the RPF was in an offensive mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think...
So then the question is, so who started it?
Yeah, I think General Dallaire is trying to give his answer as best he could, because he's under some restrictions on what he can say. When we asked to cross-examine him, he testified for almost 2 weeks in the military, one, maybe longer. We wanted 6 weeks with him, because we knew much more about him after the 4 years later. But we were allowed only 3 days from Ottawa, Defense Headquarters in Ottawa, by video link.
Yes.
And they made a mistake. We had a head and shoulders shot of him when he was testifying, but a technician at break pulled back the camera, and we saw he was surrounded by five senior Canadian Army officers in the box with him, basically.
Yes.
Commanders and colonels. We asked what they were doing there, and they couldn't explain themselves.
Yeah.
But obviously he was
handcuffed. Five witnesses is better than one.
Well, yeah. So he was obviously...
Particularly only one of the five is mentioned.
Yeah, and it would make you wonder, why would they be worried about what he would say?
Mm-hmm.
If General Dallaire is what he says, what they purport him to be, why would they be worried about what he would say?
Mm-hmm.
But they are, because they know, ask what we know about him and what he did and what the Canadian government did, not exactly what happened.
It's, I wish there, you know, they set this tribunal up and they said, we want justice to be seen to be done, and then no reporter showed up. And it was, the coverage was basically either lionization of one court figure or another, but no actual, what we call in Canada, you know, court reporting. He said, she said.
None of that.
That never happened.
The same with the Milosevic trial. They made big noises about the trials, but all you saw in the press here were prosecution press releases of what their witnesses were intended to say. They never saw any.
And that was reported. Then they said, this is what they would say.
That's right. And you never saw the cross-examinations in which they were destroyed, in which the truth came out, and the defense witnesses, nothing was mentioned. So, right. I mean, just take the Dallaire facts, for instance, the famous Dallaire facts. We proved it was a forgery in 2005, and the testimony with Colonel Kleist. And now we discovered just 2 weeks ago that the daily minutes for those 3 days of his cross-examination are missing. They don't want people to know that cross-examination
took
place.
Well, by the way, now, what if somebody wants to read the... your trial would be a great study. Is that accessible somewhere?
No, that's a problem. Unlike the ICTY, where transcripts are posted, the ICTY does not post the transcripts.
By the way, doesn't the ICTY televise its... I mean, in other words, isn't that open? You can sometimes go on the Internet and watch them?
I've never known them to be televised like the ICTY.
They did with Charles Taylor.
Yes. And the ICTY are televised, at least for some of the trials. The ICTY never televised them, although they were all videotaped. They were all videotaped.
So somebody's got a library.
Yes.
I guess we have to ask the U.S., the Pentagon, if we can have a look.
Well, George Samueli from New York tried to do just that. Just 3 weeks ago, he wrote to the tribunal saying he wanted to read the transcripts of both the Military 1 and Military 2 trials, and he told me all he got was a dance around. The one bureau said, well, I haven't got them. Maybe Joe Blow's got them. But Joe Blow said, we haven't got. We don't know where they are.
Yep.
So he got the runaround.
Yes.
So the only way you can get the transcripts is from counsel. Like, we were given the transcripts in our trial, but I have not any access to the transcripts in any other trial.
Yes. And this was a kind of important part. Transparency, particularly when it's international justice, should be...
Exactly.
The first criteria.
Yes, there's no transparency, and the public doesn't know what's going on because, I mean, these are major trials like the Nuremberg trials, but nobody knows what's going on in them. And so you get people like Gerard Kaplan writing everywhere that he knows what's going on, but he's never obviously attended any of these trials. He doesn't know what the evidence is that actually came out. So he's basing what he says and the rest of his ilk, Linda Mill, on old mythology, which has been discredited 14 years, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's a battle. There's two battles here. One, to get the transcripts so people can see, and then the other is to get those who've been acquitted and released home and to make the UN be a responsible institution. Chris Black, it's been great talking to you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On your work, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
You're welcome.
Okay, dog. Bye-bye. Christopher Black. Toronto lawyer, and we'll be talking to a former associate of his, Peter Rosenthal, in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll be right back.